So, how are you all getting along with the assignment? Some of you seems to have had problems installing VirtualBox. Is that now resolved? Yes? No? Have you looked at the assignment? All of you? Okay. And how many of you tried to set up VirtualBox? And you were able to do that. Okay. Yeah, the main problem seems to be that on some of the machines, the image that's available in the disk scratch area, that seems to be corrupted. Okay. So if you have any problems, I think the first thing to do is send an email to Ian, who is in computing support, and he'll be able to resolve that fairly quickly. Okay. And while he does that, you can start doing your work on some of the machine. Okay. Last time we started discussing congestion control, and in particular TCP congestion control. I've gone through the TCP congestion control mechanism. So what we're going to do today is briefly talk a little bit about TCP throughput and also fairness aspect, and then move on to discussing the network layer issues in chapter 4. So we've seen that TCP has different phases. It has a slow start phase and a congestion avoidance phase. The congestion avoidance phase is what is the steady state phase, where the network pretty much oscillates in the steady state phase in a sawtooth fashion, with the sender rates changing in a sawtooth fashion. So the analysis of throughput typically considers the steady state because that is the one which is relevant when you have a long-running TCP transfer, like file transfer or any of that type of traffic. So one can do a very simple analysis if we assume that you are spending half of your time trying to ramp up, and the other half of your time where your throughput is cut down by half because you encountered a loss. So if you have that sort of a very simple model of how you're switching between two states in the congestion avoidance phase, then you can come up with something very naive in terms of how the throughput is. So basically, you have a imagine that at a point in the congestion avoidance phase, the window is W. And at that time, because window is tightly related with the throughput through the RTT, we can determine that the throughput is W over RTT. And when a loss happens at that state, the window size is cut down by half, and then there is a linear increase again from the sender side. So what that means is your throughput is cut down by half. Now it becomes W over 2 times the RTT. Okay. So basically, if you do the averaging, then you end up with this number of 0.75 times W over RTT. But of course, this is fairly simplistic analysis of throughput. A bit more sophisticated analysis, but still considering only the congestion avoidance phase, gives you this expression. There is a paper in SICKCOM from the late 90s which tried to develop this simple model at the same time, also validated it using experiments for long-running TCP sessions. So if you consider this, There are two things worth noting here. One is throughput is inversely proportional to the RTT, which means if you have a very long RTT, then your throughput is going to be proportionally lower. And if you have two TCP sessions where they share a bottleneck, but they also have different RTTs, you can see that the one with the longer RTT pretty much suffers in relation with the other one. So basically, this will come up when I talk about fairness in a minute. But the other issue is about the loss rate and how sensitive your throughput is when you have a certain amount of loss. So this becomes all the more critical when you have what is called the long fat pipes. Essentially, TCP or sessions which have to go through paths with a very high bandwidth delay product. Okay, so in order to fully utilize those paths, you need to be able to be sending at a very high rate. But if you send at a very high rate, you also are very sensitive to the loss. Okay, because when you cut down by half each time, whenever you encounter a loss, that sort of affects your utilization quite a lot. So basically, that's what is being conveyed here, essentially. So if you, let's work through this example. You have this 1500 byte segments, or the maximum segment size is 1500 in this example. And you have 100 milliseconds RTT is a typical long distance internet link RTT. And also, you have a very high throughput path, 10 gigabit per second. So basically, this is the key thing here. So 10 gigabit per second makes this a much more of a fat pipe. It is long as well, but it could be much longer. If you consider a satellite link, it could be significantly longer, where you have delays in the order of close to a second. Okay. So, but overall, the bandwidth delay product is relevant. So basically here, in order to keep the pipe busy, you need to be able to send packets, or your window size should be quite big. And the window size can be determined by taking the throughput times the RTT, okay? Because throughput is window over the RTT. And if you want to determine the window, then you have throughput times the RTT is what gives you a window size. And if you work that out, you get the window size to be this big. Okay, so you need to be able to support large window size. That is one message. The second message is the sensitivity to loss that I was alluding to. And here, the same thing. The throughput expression can be given by this when you focus on the steady state condition avoidance phase. And in that case, if you plug in 10 gigabit per second as your throughput, and maximum segment size is 1500 and RTT is 100 milliseconds, then you end up with loss in the, or the required amount of loss to be equal to 2 times 10 to the power of minus 10, okay, which is significantly low and very impractical. I mean, even for links which only involve fiber links, or paths involving only fiber links, this is a bit unreasonable, okay, because you still have links on the ends of those paths which will become bottlenecks and may have to drop packets because of buffer overflow. So basically what this means is, if you want to sustain this kind of a throughput using TCP, then your loss should be almost negligible. Okay, far from negligible, in a way, but very negligible. This was the motivation behind a number of TCP enhancements, sort of variants of TCP, and other alternatives to TCP as well. There is a protocol called XCP, which has got a lot of attention, which is sort of a clean slate design of transport layer protocol for the internet. So all of these were motivated by this fact that TCP is not very efficient when you deal with high bandwidth delay product links. Okay, so that's to bear in mind. Obviously, given the scope of what we have to, what we're going to talk about in this course, we're not going to go through the details of those advanced protocols. But I think it is important to understand and appreciate the issue that motivates all that work. So the next issue is about fairness. So fairness comes into play when you have a resource which is in scarce supply, and you have a lot of demand, especially when you have multiple users trying to share that resource. So in that context, the canonical model that is used is what is shown here, where you have multiple hosts trying to have TCP connections across a single bottleneck source, a bottleneck router, okay? And the bottleneck router has an outgoing link capacity of R. Now, if TCP is fair, everyone should get their part of the share equally when going through this bottleneck router. Now, does TCP ensure that is the question. And it turns out that TCP, even though it was, it has several limitations in terms of having to work with implicit feedback and trying to use this rate throttling and increase in a somewhat heuristic way, it is quite sophisticated in other ways, in the sense of ensuring fairness. Okay. So that can be seen using classical analysis by Chu and Jain from the late 80s. So this established that TCP, in fact, is fair. And TCP has these two phases, like I said, the slow start and the congestion avoidance phase. In the congestion avoidance phase, it uses what is called the additive increase multiplicative decrease algorithm. And oftentimes, you're going to just focus on that because, you know, that is what is relevant when you have reasonably long TCP flow. Okay, the slow start part is only relevant when you're just starting off. So if you focus on that, the AIMD algorithm is actually fair to multiple flows crossing a bottleneck router. Okay, and the way this analysis goes is illustrated pictorially, where whenever you increase linearly, you go along a line with a slope equals 1 in this picture. So basically, for one connection here, we're focusing on two connections to make it easy to visualize this thing. If you have three or more connections, the picture becomes more complicated because you have that many dimensions to look at. But focusing on this two-dimensional case, where the increase is trying to go along a slope of 1, and decrease is trying to sort of decrease your throughput and basically halving. So basically, you sort of keep progressing in this fashion, each of these connections as you pass through a router. And the same thing happens for the other connection as well, depending, regardless of the initial state, okay? So the initial state could be that, you know, the connection 2 may be having a throughput of equals R, but that doesn't matter. You sort of adapt over time to end up along this line which indicates the equal bandwidth share. Okay, so on that portion, you have each of them getting R over 2 bandwidth. And they keep oscillating in that along that line, okay? So that is sort of the beauty of the TCP congestion control mechanism, in the sense that it is not only efficient for reasonable links in terms of bandwidth delay product, but also it is fair, regardless of the number of flows, okay? Uh, But it is also unfair when you consider a bit more subtle scenarios. Like, for instance, I alluded to one scenario where you may have two flows with differing RTT values. In that case, TCP is unfair. Okay, because the one with the longer RTT will have lower throughput, which sort of gives away more share of the bottleneck resource to the shorter flow. Okay, so that is one instance of unfairness that comes in. But of course, you know, it is a bit of a special case where you know you have two diverse types of flows crossing a bottleneck resource. And the other types of other type of unfairness comes when you try to cheat and use multiple TCP connections from a user as opposed to a single TCP connection. So imagine that, so consider this example where you have a link, bottleneck link of rate R, and it is already supporting 9 connections. And imagine that each of those connections correspond to a different application, okay? So basically you have 9 users, 9 connections, and each of them is getting R over 9 share of the bandwidth, okay? Now, you could, have a new application, that is you, coming into the network and start one TCP connection that crosses that bottleneck link, and in which case, pretty much everyone else's share is going to be cut down by a little, and then you get that piece of the share. Essentially, the new share for each of the 10 TCP connections would be R over 10, and that is one scenario. The other scenario is you could cheat, and you can instead start 11 TCP connections, or any number for that matter, so more than one, in which case you would get more than half of the share, because it is the fairness is on a per connection basis. So basically you have 11 over 20 share, which is more than half of the bottleneck resource. So in a way, this is something which often HTTP tries to exploit. For different reasons. We have seen that HTTP has this so-called non-persistent and persistent versions. And if you have the non-persistent version, where for every object that you need to fetch, you start a new connection, then in a way, because of the TCP behavior, you can benefit. Although from the end system resource utilization in terms of the buffers and the state information, it may not be very scalable. It is very good from trying to share or get a better share in at the bottleneck sources. The other issue of fairness is not a problem with TCP per se, but the presence of UDP can be a problem, because UDP doesn't have any notion of congestion control, which means that it can send as fast as it wants, really. And that can pretty much mess up any kind of TCP fairness behavior, okay? Because you pretty much have an uncontrolled source or set of UDP sources that pretty much do not behave in a way TCP expects, and therefore, you know, TCP fairness is affected when you have UDP flows. And because of this, to be a good citizen in the internet, there are proposals to make UDP include some notion of congestion control. Although it is not called UDP anymore, there are a set of proposals called TCP friendly rate control and other DCCP. Basically, there are a number of proposals which are there today, which try to give the applications a protocol like UDP, which doesn't have this reliability support, it doesn't have this connection establishment and so forth, but yet include some notion of congestion control. Okay, so that pretty much everyone can behave like good citizens within the core of the internet. Okay. So that's pretty much what we have to discuss under the transport layer. Okay. So we've seen a number of issues, multiplexing, demultiplexing, that is common to both TCP and UDP. I've seen fundamental reliable data transfer protocols, which you're implementing as part of your assignment. Seen flow control, condition control, in the context of TCP mainly. And of course, some of the details of how these protocols are specified, including the segment structure and so forth. Okay. So what we're going to do now is look at the network layer. Okay. So the network layer is a layer immediately below the transport layer in the Internet Protocol stack or the TCP/IP stack. The network layer provides a host-to-host datagram transfer service. Okay. So that can be seen through an example. So basically, you have end hosts where the transport layer offers a process-to-process transport service or communication service, and you may have different processes using different ports, relying on the transport layer service. But the transport layer service is dependent on what the network layer offers, and network layer doesn't really care which process a particular message corresponds to. It only cares about just getting the packets in from any other host in the network, and likewise sending to the destination host. Okay. And in doing so, it is not sufficient to include only the end systems. So that is the crucial difference here. In order to maintain a host-to-host communication service, it is important to involve the routers and basically all devices in the core of the internet as well. So far, we didn't touch anything inside the core of the internet. Okay. So the transport layer and above, transport layer application, and if you have session presentation layers, all of them are limited to purely end systems. So that's one crucial difference. And when you send packets in the internet, the routing involves looking up these packets because they route themselves through the destination address inside them. So basically, the routers have to look at each packet as they go through. So basically, they have to determine the routes, and that is done separately from forwarding the packet. So we'll see the difference between these two functions in a moment. So basically, let's see, if you want to send a packet or a network layer datagram that includes a transport layer segment. Okay. So recall the terminology. At the application layer, we have messages. At the transport layer, we deal with segments, and at the network layer, we have datagrams, and link layer, we deal with frames and physical layer bits. Okay, so that's the standard terminology. In that terminology, if you want to send a network layer datagram from this particular host to this particular host, then you sort of use the network layer services and pretty much engage in the network layer in all the intermediate routers on the way to the destination. Okay, so that's the key thing. Previously, we didn't have to worry about engaging the transport layer at any of the intermediate routers because they're not relevant at all. Okay, and the other thing is your datagram has to pass through the network layer up to the network layer of each and every intermediate router. So basically, the involvement means that looking at the header of the pack, the datagram, and then figuring out where to go next. So like I was saying, the network layer, some of the key functions that the network layer does include determining the routes and forwarding datagrams based on those routes. Okay, so these are two different functions. So they seem similar, but they mean different things. Okay, so routing is essentially the act of determining the routes, and this is done through the use of a routing protocol like the distance vector or link state type of protocols. We'll see these protocols later on. If you have taken an algorithms course and looked at, studied graph algorithms, then shortest path algorithms are very relevant when you're discussing routing, because we often deal with finding routes that are shortest in some in the context of some cost metric. Okay, so that's what routing is. Now, once you have routing complete its job and determine the routes from every node to every other node, from a node's perspective, a node here means the router, because you know that's what we are focusing on in the network core. And from a core router perspective, you have a route to every other node in the network. Now the question is, when you have a packet coming in, you have to determine where to send it out, because you may have many different links incident on you. So basically, how to go to the next hop for that particular packet is the forwarding function. Okay, so it is, in a way, consumer of the routing protocol's output. Okay, so in a way, forwarding is what you do with the data packets based on what routing protocols do. So basically, one can visualize this through an example where the routing algorithm populates the local forwarding table. So based on where the packets need to go and what output link they should take if they come to a particular router. So if the packet header contains this as the destination, 0111, then your forwarding table suggests that the packet should take the output link 2, which means basically the packet is sent forward on that link. And that is what the forwarding does. And the fact that it is simple is a good thing, but it still involves searching through your forwarding table to find out what the right output link is. Okay, and that itself can be a big issue when you're dealing with high-speed links in the core of the internet. When you have links which are generating traffic to you as a router at gigabit per second, then you have to keep up by trying to do these lookups, the forwarding table lookups, fast enough, so that you know you don't become the bottleneck in trying to process each packet. So you have to do this fast processing of IP packets. So basically, the conceptual simplicity is one thing, but also implementation-wise, it is fairly involved when you have high-speed links. So you have routing, you have forwarding. The other function that is relevant when you have a connection-oriented network layer is the connection setup process. So basically here, you try and realize a notion of circuit-switched communications over a packet-switched network. So basically the circuit-switched, circuit-switching versus packet-switching that we considered early on is more at a fundamental or an abstract level, where circuit switching pretty much involves physical layer circuits. Okay, so basically, just like your telephone wires are stitched together on demand in hardware to establish an end-to-end circuit for you to make phone calls. So this is basically the old-fashioned way of sort of supporting voice communication through the fixed landline infrastructure. But in the context of the internet, or in the context of data communication networks, it is also common to realize circuit switching-like functionality, but with packets, some notion of a packet involved. Okay, like if you consider the ATM network, it uses the small cells, or the packets are called cells in that context, and they use fixed size small cells, 48 byte cells, which pretty much flow from the source to the destination via a circuit that you establish before communicating any data. So this, because you're trying to do this in a sort of virtual way, they are sometimes referred to as virtual circuits. Okay, so you have connections relevant when you use a network layer, a connection-oriented network layer service like ATM. And here, the connection is between the host, not between processes. So previously, if you consider TCP, it involves establishing a connection between the client process and the server process. Okay, so that is different from having a connection at the network layer, because you really don't have any connection with the higher level application here. So it's almost like a pipe that you stitch together between the endpoints. And the endpoint has to do demultiplexing to figure out, which process the incoming data corresponds to. Okay, so that's an important distinction to bear in mind. So we'll come back to this connection setup a bit more when we try and compare connection-oriented network layer service with connection-less service. Okay. So just to emphasize, the one that is used by default in the internet, the IP layer, is a connection-less network layer service. Okay, but like I said, ATM is something which is used in specific contexts, used to be used more in the old days, which is a connection-oriented service that can sit underneath the IP layer. So basically you have overall a connection-oriented service. So the network layer, the transport layer, we've seen that, it can, it should be providing services that meet the requirements of applications. Okay, and the applications can require various types of guarantees, like loss, resilience to loss, some sort of bandwidth guarantees, some sort of delay guarantees, some sort of security guarantees, and so forth. The same things are relevant even when you consider the interface between the network and the transport layer. Here, the network layer has to ideally meet the requirements of the transport layer. Okay, and this is in the abstract, not just limited to the internet context. Okay. And these sort of service requirements could be, as shown here, it could be at the individual datagram level, or it could be at the flow level, where you have two endpoints communicating with each other, and that forms a flow. And in that in the flow context, you might require certain guarantees from the network layer. So it could be either or, and the question is, what do existing network layers provide? Okay, because in some ways you could expect whatever you may want to expect, but also what you are presented with is something that you have to live with. Okay, so it turns out that what internet provides is actually very bare bones, almost like UDP. Okay, so it doesn't do anything. So it doesn't give you any kind of guarantees, and it also doesn't, by default, it doesn't also give you any kind of congestion feedback as well. So in a way, it's almost like leaving all the responsibility to the transport layer and application layers to live with this bare-bones service. So, which means that it also limits those layers, So if the underlying layer doesn't provide any of these guarantees, then some of these cannot be provided at a layer above. Because in a way, if you have packets routed on paths which have very high congestion, then the ability of the transport layer to ensure any kind of delay guarantee is not possible.
Okay.
So that's the type of thing that I was I'm indicating here. So where if the network layer does some work for you, then you can sort of present the applications with a better service. But if network layer doesn't do anything, like in the case of internet or the IP, you pretty much have to let go of some of these guarantees as you go up. But only thing that TCP is able to do on top of this is it deals with loss. It provides reliability, and it also ensures in-order delivery. These are possible to do, but the trade-off is the timing. So basically, timing and bandwidth. Okay. So basically, you take longer to recover from losses, and you also take longer to make sure that packets come in order before you give it to the application. So basically, you give away the timing, and also in doing that, you also give away the bandwidth, because you know, bandwidth is basically how long you take to transfer a given amount of data. So basically, if you're taking longer, then automatically your bandwidth also comes down. And it deals with congestion in a manner that doesn't require network layer feedback. So that's what the internet does. So the ATM is a bit better in the sense that it gives a variety of options to the user. In terms of various combinations of this. So we've seen this ATM ABR service last time around in this context in terms of a network layer feedback context. But it has other variants as well in terms of various types of services it provides. As you can see, it's sort of is slightly better compared to what the internet offers. So this is precisely the motivation for using ATM in certain contexts where you have to support voice communication. So voice communication is highly delay sensitive, and in order to have this timing guarantee, you would need network layer support, and ATM comes in as a result of that. Okay. So that's about the service models at the network layer. Now, going back to this issue of connection setup and how that is relevant, let's look at virtual circuit versus datagram networks. Virtual circuit networks are connection-oriented network layer services, and datagram networks do not use any notion of a connection. So here, I think most of it I've said, I think let me see. So we are having this host-to-host service, and the implementation was modifying the network core. This thing I did not quite mention here. Network provides one or the other. So basically, the network architecture is an hourglass model, okay? Which means you may have many different applications, several transport protocols, but you have a common network layer, okay? A single network layer service, which could be like an ATM type of a service or internet type of a service. And then you could have many different data link layers, many different physical layers, okay? So that's the way network architecture is typically. And in a way, the network layer is like a glue between these diverse things that sits above it and also the diverse things that are below it, okay? So given this, you have to make a choice as to what kind of service you want. So you may live with what the internet IP service provides, and that becomes pretty much your network layer and also limits what you can do about, okay? On the other hand, you can choose something like an ATM service and pretty much incur the additional overheads that come with connection setup and so forth. But it gives you certain benefits because you know, if you want to ensure some sort of a timing guarantee, it has a service that does that. So pretty much you're making this pick. But this is not the whole story, actually, because you know you can overlay one over the other and pretty much present that as your network layer. Okay, so that is very commonly done, where you use IP and have ATM underneath. Pretty much, in a way, IP can be very bare bones network layer protocol, but underneath that, you have this very sophisticated connection-oriented protocol, and then when you stitch them together into a single network layer, you can get the best of both. Okay, so that can be a choice as well. In a way, it's like a hybrid between the two. Okay. So that said, that makes it relevant to discuss this virtual circuits a bit more. Okay. So, like in circuit switching, we have to establish a circuit or a connection prior to any kind of data communication. And the circuit pretty much specifies the path that the data should take. Okay. So it pins you down to those set of links for any subsequent data packets. And each packet carries some sort of an identifier for the circuit. Unlike what we discussed earlier, where each packet is routed using the destination address. So when I was talking about routing versus forwarding, I mentioned that you use the destination address of the packet as a way to figure out which output link you should take at each intermediate router. that is not how things are done in a virtual circuit network. So you have an identifier for the virtual circuit that pretty much is sitting inside each packet, and you use that to look up where to go next, okay, at each intermediate router, not the destination address. And because you have to have these virtual circuits per connection, and per flow between any pair of nodes that want to communicate, and your forwarding is dependent on those virtual circuit identifiers, each of the routers in the network have to maintain state about the individual flows. Okay, so this is again unlike what we discussed before, where you really don't care which flow a particular packet belongs to. The packet has the destination address in the header, and you just use that to figure out where to send it out. Okay, so that is one model which is very simple, whereas here you have to have this additional state where you have to figure out which flow the packet corresponds to. According to the flow that the packet corresponds to, you have to figure out what its outgoing link is. So this becomes clear when we look at an example. Now, once you set up this virtual circuit, you could do resource reservation, okay, like in the standard circuit switched context, where you could use some sort of TDM, FDM type of mechanism to reserve resources for the flow. And by doing so, you can guarantee some kind of a service. So basically, the various services within ATM try to do this. Basically, you try to allocate some resources, and in a way, you shield that resource from being used by other flows. And as a result, you can ensure that your packets arrive in time and with less jitter and so forth. So that's something that you can do once you have a connection or a virtual circuit. In terms of the implementation, I think probably it's much easier to go through this using an example. So you set up the virtual circuit, and when doing that, what you do is for each link on the path, so virtual circuit pretty much pins down the path that the source and destination needs to use. And for each link on that path, you assign a virtual circuit identifier. And the identifier could be different for different links on that path. Okay, and this is for scalability. If you could actually, in theory, you could use just one single identifier for each link on a path, which is globally unique. But globally, unique identifiers are hard to achieve in practice because in some ways you need to make sure that no one else is using that. And this global coordination is a huge amount of overhead. So therefore, in practice, typically each link uses a different identifier, but these are all stitched together to form your virtual circuit. Okay. So imagine that you have this virtual circuit set up with different identifiers for different links on the path. Now the question is, how do you forward packets in the virtual circuit context? So the way you do is you have a table like this at each router, which does the mapping between incoming interface, incoming virtual circuit number, and outgoing interface and outgoing virtual circuit number. So imagine that there is nothing about the destination. Basically, the virtual circuit implicitly knows where the packet is destined to. Okay, but explicitly, there is no reference to the destination. So the packet might be going here, or packet might be going here, or wherever. You really don't care, because you know that was done by an earlier step when trying to establish the circuit. So you do a lookup. So for instance, you have a packet coming on this interface 1 with an VC number of 12. Then this table shows that it should go out on interface 3 with a VC number of 22. So what you do is you rewrite the VC number in the packet by erasing 12 and then making it 22, and then send it out on 3, the output interface 3. And that's how you deal with packets at each and every router. You rely on this type of forwarding table. So here, it is clear that you're maintaining per connection state, because you know these VC numbers are nothing but connections. So in a way, if you have a million connections passing through a router, this particular table will have entries in the order of million. It is not just a million, but it could be more than that, because you know you also have multiple interfaces that you have to deal with. So in a way, the state information that you have to maintain keeps changing with the number of active connections, and also you are in a way connection dependent in the virtual circuit context. But sort of there is no clear argument in terms of whether there's a good thing or a bad thing, because you know it's all relative. So we'll do that comparison in a minute. So signaling protocols are used to do this connection setup, tear down part of it. I think you know it's probably obvious how this happens. We've seen how connections are set up in the context of TCP. Conceptually, it's very similar. It's just that you know, in terms of the details, it's a bit different. Here we set up these VC numbers and plug in the state at each intermediate router while doing this connection setup. So that is about the virtual circuit networks. Now coming to the datagram networks, here there is no connection setup before data transmission. So each packet pretty much is a connection here, okay? So in a way, each packet has enough information inside it to route itself from the source to the destination. At each node, so now we can go back to this earlier thing that I said about routing versus forwarding, where you have a routing protocol that establishes the routes between every node to every other node, and that populates the forwarding tables at every node. Now, forwarding tables are indexed by destinations, okay? So destination address. Now, when a packet comes in, you look up the destination in the packet and then see where it should go out, and then that's how you send out the packets, okay? And basically, this is the model that is, you know, the default in the internet. So the same example like before. Now, one issue that is relevant here is this table can be also quite big if you construct it in a naive way. Okay. So previously in the virtual circuit context, the table can be quite big because you may have a lot of connections to deal with. Okay. Here, the table could be quite big because there are a lot of destinations that you have to deal with. Okay. So if you consider the IPv4 addresses, this could be about 4 billion. But one thing you could do is you can aggregate them. So basically, there is a lot of commonality, and oftentimes you have a small number of outgoing links. So like in a core network, you probably may have at most 10 or 20 output ports.